Welcome to the Growth Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the co-founder and CEO at procurementexpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing with magical features. This podcast will be good for you if you want to know more what it's like to work at Procurement Express, or if you want to become a customer and know who we are. But it's especially good if you want to learn how to self-fund a business. And this is something that happens to me occasionally and a lot to my guests, which people come and ask me, hey, I've got a business idea. And rather than give them an answer, which I wouldn't be able to have a very good answer for, I always refer them to this talk that we're going to talk about today. It's with my guest, Jason Cohen. He's bootstrapped four different software businesses from zero to over $1 million in revenue. And then on top of that, in his latest venture, WP Engine, which I guess is not so latest anymore. It's been almost 10 years.
13 years.
Wow. Okay. He raised money, went the other track, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars raised. Last time, what I could find online, there's over 1,000 customers with well over 100,000 customers and 1,000 employees. With revenue well over $200 million a year. Is that still correct? The problem with all these fast-starting businesses is your numbers are out of date by the time you Google them. So does that sound right? Have I told anyone a lie?
No, it's even bigger than that, but you're right. That's the right ballpark. And I also mentioned we have more than 100 people in Ireland.
Now, that is very interesting. I didn't know that. Where do you have your team in Ireland?
Well, we have an office in Limerick, like a physical office that no one wants to come to thanks to COVID. But a lot of people did come in before COVID. But we've hired all around the country now in the post-COVID era. So a lot in Limerick for that reason, because that's where the office was. But now, you know, you name it, there's probably a few people there.
Well, I could be controversial and say that no one wants to go to Limerick full stop. But that's because I'm from Dublin. And, you know, that's just...
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to start any kind of wars here.
Yeah, well, we could go down a line of conversation there, but I value my personal safety. So we'll just leave it there. So why are you here? So you're here because you gave this amazing talk in 2013. So just a bit of context, I'm doing a podcast series, which gives you an idea of why Procurement Express started and where it came from. Two episodes ago, I interviewed my business partner, Richard, and he came to me with the business idea for Procurement Express. And I would have totally ignored him, except for one reason, one thing, which is I'd just come back from Las Vegas, where I'd seen you, Jason, give this talk on the attributes of an ideal self-funded software business. And the great thing about this talk was, well, there were, you know, lots of people telling their story, which was great and inspiring, and showing how they'd done it. You sort of flipped the script and you said, hold on, forget about what you should be doing. It's not about e-commerce or SaaS or whatever. It's like, what do you want this business to give you? What are the attributes of a great business? And you gave a couple of different attributes that really stuck with me. And when Rich pitched his idea, they like ticked all the boxes, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just say, for me, in a sentence, if I had to summarize. Now, this talk is incredibly dense. And you got to Google Jason Cohen, Microconf 2013 on YouTube. I was going through it again before this interview, and it's so dense. But if I had to try and summarize it in a sentence, I would say what you want to do if you want to self-start a business and you want to bootstrap it or self-fund it. So what you got to do is you got to solve a recurring problem for finance teams, funding marketing by getting them to prepay annually for your service. Now, that's what I heard at that talk. How would you describe it if people asked you what it was about 10 years later?
That's right. The title is Making a Bootstrapped Cash Machine. And there's, of course, a lot of details in there. And also, I try to motivate all of these little quote-unquote rules. Of course, as we all know in life, rules are not that. They're not laws of physics. All of them can be broken. But the idea is not that they're rules, but rather this makes it easier. Like either this will make life easier or it de-risks the company in some way. So you're not going to do them all probably, but the more that you do, maybe the company's more likely to succeed or easier to do. So for example, the recurring part. If you want to charge people every month, somehow you need to be delivering value every month. So one very common failure mode is people say, well, I want a recurring revenue business because that's good for me, the business owner, which it is because it's more predictable and blah, blah, blah. But then they make a product which delivers value once and they expect people to keep paying every month, but they don't need it next month, or it's not delivering that much value next month, or nothing's changed. Or maybe it's good for 6 months and then it's not valuable anymore. So for example, I'll see people who have software that has to do with event management, event planning, but events don't happen every month. Now, if someone has something where events are happening every month, that's great. If that's your target audience, then actually we're back to good again. But if someone's doing a one-off event, what happens is they get your software anyway, and then they stop paying 3 months later. But that's not recurring revenue. That's just getting money. Hence the recurring. So do you have to make a recurring revenue business? Of course you don't. it's just really, really nice. At SmartBear, my second to last company, it was not recurring revenue, and it's really tough. Every month the clock sort of starts, or the counter starts at zero. And you wonder, can I make payroll and so forth every month? And it's stressful. And of course, that's how most companies work. So it's not like you can't do that. But in software, there's been a revolution in the last couple of decades where people do expect to pay monthly for software that's hosted. And if you can get away with that, it's a lot better for your stress level and the longevity of your company. You know that next month, almost everyone will stay. You can already count on that. It's just so enormous for your operations and planning and spending, and also just for your emotional state. It's really, really great. So do you have to do that? Of course not. But look, it's easier. It's nicer. But to do that has to be coupled with actually generating value every month. So finance is a great way to do that, because finance has cycles, monthly cycles, and then quarterly and annual cycles too, depending on what your software is, or somewhat continuous, like if you're doing something like purchase orders or accounts payable or something. Sure, there's monthly closes and stuff, so that's still true, but also just continuously every day they're using it. Any product that you use every day, every business day, that's automatically going to be something that is recurring and probably valuable. Google has a name for those. They call it a toothbrush product, something you use once or twice a day. Hopefully twice, and so Google famously said they're only going to look at toothbrush products. They'll just never have products that are not toothbrush products. Now, that sounds like an ideal, but it is one of these things. Like, is that a rule? Of course not. But if the product is a toothbrush product, like an AP product might be, then that is better, isn't it? And you can probably charge any way you want, and you're going to be valuable all the time, top of mind all the time, maybe integrated into workflows, which makes you more sticky. Like, so yeah, that's true. If it's a toothbrush product, this probably is better overall, or makes life a little easier overall. So yeah, it's a good rule of thumb. So those are some specifics which are useful in themselves and in isolation, but the talk is really a whole bunch of things such as that, all these little pieces that are like, but this makes it a little easier. This is a little better. So not that you have to take the whole package, but these are a bunch of nice ingredients. When you build your meal, it's not a bad idea to use some of these ingredients, you know?
Yeah, well, my wife does explainer videos, and she gets like $5,000. She gets $5,000 up front, let's say, for an explainer video. And she's like, oh, I'm so jealous of you. You got a recurring revenue. I said, what? You just got $5,000. It'll take me like 2 or 3 years to get that money, you know? Just don't spend it so fast.
The grass is always greener. So to me, there is an answer to that too. This grass is always greener. What do you do? What you do is, it can take time to get here, but you figure out what those 1, 2, or 3 absolutely most critical things are that define the product or make it successful, or that lean into your strengths or capabilities. You're like, this is key. This is absolutely critical for how we're going to win. And then all the other decisions need to be consistent with that. So that's how you start resolving this question of like, well, I could do recurring revenue and I get a little bit of money every month, but it's predictable, or I could just do once, but it's a big lump and I get all the cash now and I can spend that cash now. That's incredibly valuable. That's why, as you said, annual recurring is better than monthly recurring for that very same reason. So which do I pick? So you can go back to like, well, what are those fundamental things which take time and effort to try to figure out? That's not trivial, but they're worth figuring out, because then you can say, ah, because I'm adhering to these primary principles that I have, I can pick which of those are more consistent with them. So for example, you might say, I'm selling to finance folks. They are used to thinking on a monthly schedule. Their budget is monthly. Their activities are monthly, blah, blah, blah. So my business is going to be monthly. Everything I do is going to be monthly. Will it be better if they paid up front? Yes, it would. And maybe you give them the option to, fair enough, but you're not going to make them. Never, ever. There's always going to be monthly, because I have this principle. There's a monthly thing, and everything we do is monthly. We're going to send them a report monthly. We're going to be billing them monthly. We're going to, you know, whatever. Like, everything's going to be in this specific cycle. And if we're completely consistent with that, then that's going to make the most sense to our customers. That's good information. will arrive to them in a pattern that they want, and everything's going to be aligned that way. They're going to get this report about this amazing stuff we did for them last month, and then they're going to get the bill monthly, but separated by a day. So it's top of mind how much value we just created for them, and then the bill, so that they always think, oh, yeah, this is great stuff, and not in some other pattern that doesn't match. Now, do you have to do that? No, I'm just, it's an example of what I mean by, if you have some of these principles or some of these thoughts, you're like, yeah. So like, it's like a, you could almost say it's a philosophy, but we have this rule or pattern or thing, like this is part of how we're going to operate to win. This is part of what makes sense to us or to our customers. So that's how we're going to be thinking about everything. So when someone says annual, we'll say, that's good for us, but it doesn't match that pattern. So maybe we shouldn't even have annual. Or, okay, but it's optional and we're not even going to press the issue because it'd be kind of nice for us. But, and if people want to opt in, that's fantastic, but we're not going to really press that point because it's against our main idea here that everything is monthly. Or another kind of thing that might make sense for finance, depending on what it is we get paid when you get paid. So payment processing can be like that. When you charge the payment, then we take a cut, not before. Or when some of your bad debt gets collected on anyway, we take a piece of that collection. Again, you're saying like, it could be this principle, when you win, we win. And you can just see how that would move into pricing and packaging. You could see how that could move into how you talk about what the product is even for. Mm-hmm. You could justify a higher price perhaps, because if you just say we charge you 100 euro every time we collect something, that may or may not make sense. But if you say, look, every time we help you collect 100 euro, we just take just 20 for having done it, and you get 80%. And you were going to get zero before, or at least that's the implication. Yeah. That feels really fair, but that could actually be a high price. I don't know. But having just spoken about it, and when you win, then we win, or first you eat, then we eat, like that kind of a notion, if that's imbued in the positioning on the website and how you talk about it, first you win, then we win. That's a whole different sales pitch than like, you can save money and, we'll go get the, it's a different pitch to say, we're going to make sure you get more money. Then and only then we'll eat too, and together we'll win. That's a really neat concept. Could result in the same product and the same kind of pricing, but it's just a different positioning. Mm-hmm. And it might suggest different features. When you add additional features, how does it still adhere to that? So that's still the idea. And who would want to quit on a company or leave a company that has that kind of an attitude? I don't know. Like, I think it sets you up better to win just to have that attitude probably. So again, I'm making all this stuff up, so it may or may not be applicable in any given place. But this notion of like, who are we? What is our strengths? How is it that we are going to approach the market, or what unique things might we have where we win? That can be in that list. And then I can resolve these questions, because clearly there's always lots of ways to price, and they're probably all smart in some way. So coming back to some kinds of principles that we want to reinforce, that's a way to decide which of these very rational options are actually right for us. Because it's not a matter of monthly's good, but monthly's bad, annual's good. No, not necessarily. How do we pick for us consistency?
One of the interesting things was 10 years ago, you recommended you work back from 10K a month in revenue per founder. And what links into what you're saying there is that we pay our mortgage or our rent monthly, right? Which I guess it's good for the customer. It's good for us if they also in a monthly cycle, and then we can have a clear target. Okay, we got 300 customers, $66 a month, bang, my rent and whatever. I did find it interesting that like 10 years later, it's still 10K. Like inflation doesn't exist seemingly. Like it's still like when I see people, and we'll talk about pricing a little bit. You go as far as recommending like specific price points to start off with, like $49.99, $249 per month for your first product, which was brilliant. And we took and we stuck them straight on our website so I can vouch for them. But tough luck, you can't get it for that price anymore. But what does it say about pricing and psychology that the price? I still see those price points around the place. I still see people trying to get to their first 10K, even though clearly it's at least double as expensive to live today as it was back then, I'm guessing, if you read the newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, obviously, when you pick a number like that, you've got to take it in context and apply it in your context. It could be 8,000, it could be 15,000, right? It's just, of course, it depends on the situation. The story behind it, though, I think is right and allows you to come up with the right number, which is simply, to me, when a person can devote themselves 100% to the company, it's a whole different ballgame. So while you still need a day job or you're doing consulting and all this kind of stuff, you have this massive distraction. And in fact, it needs to come first because it's how you're paying the bills. You can't get laid off from your job and you need to cover, you know, enough for, and once you have a consulting client, you have to treat them well and so forth. So you're distracted by something else, which takes a lot of your time and has to be first priority. So the company that you're trying to start, it has the leftover time, leftover energy, second priority. Obviously, that's not giving it the best shot at success, right? Like, just can't be, that can't be right. But it needs it. We all know most startups fail. That's math. So knowing that it's a high risk, difficult thing, it's also second citizen and low energy and low time and on the side, like, oh my gosh, like, you know, that can't be a good combination, right? Now you have to, though, like, if you don't have savings to live on or you don't want to, then you have no choice. Okay. But the moment that you can quit that first thing, and so that the startup is the primary thing that you're spending all your time and money on, totally changes the game, how much progress you can make. Even the ideas you have when you wake up at 2 a.m. thinking about whatever, that's what happens when you're totally immersed. So even some of that sort of intangible human emotional thing, it changes when it's your only, is your sole focus. There's also a little bit of a burn the bridges thing. You're probably not really burning the bridges. You can probably go get a job, but there's a little bit of that, like, well, I don't have a job, so this had better work. There's a little bit of that motivation, which, you know, for better or worse, is highly motivating. And again, it's so hard to do these things emotionally and physically to get startups off the ground, that if that motivation might be really helpful to press through the hard times and make it work, and et cetera. So bottom line is, you need to be able to quit your normal source of income so that this is your sole source of income, because everything changes around that. It's so much better, so much more likely this company will succeed and so forth. So I picked out at 10 grand a month as a totally random number, which obviously will be different for different people in different phases in their life, with different responsibilities in different places in the world and so on, and willing to do different things. Some people are like, I'm going to move to Thailand and live in whatever, and I only need it. It's like, great. Then of course your number is different. So yeah, we wouldn't get fixated on the number. I do get fixated on the idea of it. When you can devote all your time, it's different. And that's a good first goal. I mean, obviously you want to grow from there, of course, but like, it's such a clear milestone to set yourself as a goal, and you can work backwards. All right, let's just for round numbers say 10,000 is right, you know, of course. And then you say, oh, well, if my price point is this, then I need this many customers. And now you have a dartboard. I need 300 customers or whatever. And right now I have 17. Okay.
Yeah.
But it's a big gap, but like, that's a thing that you could reason about. Is it possible that AdWords could close the gap, or is it not even possible? If you went on podcasts and guest posted on stuff, could you claw your way to 300 customers? Even if that's not a good way to scale, not a good way to get customers forever, not repeatable, it takes way too much time. But if you could claw your way to 300 with stuff that does not scale, so that you could quit your job and have all the time, maybe you should, even though those things won't scale. So again, I'm asking that rhetorically, but you see how it immediately starts. You start thinking those different things I could do, with different options, different solutions that might get me to this 300 number, because now I have this very specific and smaller number than, you know, whatever my ambitions are. I want it to be a $10 million company someday, whatever. So I'll need tens of thousands of customers. Sure, someday, but like, that's not the next milestone. So that's where all that came from. I still think that's a good way of thinking about it. And even doing stuff that you won't repeat later, just to get to the point where it's self-sufficient and you're only thinking about it, that is worth it, in my opinion. There's many ways to do it. In my opinion, that's a great way to do it, because of the phase transition, as physicists would say, that happens when it's your only thing that you're doing.
Yeah, I like that. Like, it's much of a stair step, what Rob Walling calls it, which is like, first job, you know, pay your rent and your food. That means a lot more than probably any of the other steps. Next one, get people to do the work you used to do, I guess, you know, in some cases, if you want to do that. And then I feel like the next one after that, then, is the step you've taken, which is, you know, you're wealthy enough that it's not about the day job. You're going to die with money in the bank, as Tim Ferriss calls it. So you can afford to maybe start maybe going for a bigger win or start investing or whatever. And there are discrete points in time you're aiming for. And you know, once you got the rent, then okay, now it's on to building a great team. Once you got a great team, then you're maybe trying to change the world or whatever. But there, it's not a smooth curve.
No, but it can be. Like, there's certainly people who start out saying, my goal is to change the world, and here we go. So there's many ways to do it. But this to me is a practical way that maybe has a greater chance of success.
Yeah, I'm a bootstrapper by nature, and we're getting towards the bootstrapper versus VC thing, which I don't want to go down the route too much. But like, when I hear people going from nothing saying, I'm going to change the world, I say, well, you're selling an investment, and I get that, and that's great. You're really good at it, and that's great. But I wonder, like, if you said, okay, you're selling your story, or I'll put $10 million on your desk right now, do you still want to change the world? Or how genuine is that? I'm always wondering, because they can't say anything else, right? If they want to really go for the moon, swing for the moon.
It's a great question. And there are people who will, in fact, want to do the company, whether they're right or not. But at least they're genuine in their desire. So that's cool, you know? But yeah, that's a really good point. And I like those kinds of simplifying thought experiments to find out what people really think. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, now pricing is awesome subject, and it's infinitely exciting for me to talk about it. But I've seen, you know, you talked in the original talk about, you know, picking up pennies is hard to do. And I guess when you're just going for that, paying for the rent, if I'm taking, like, the best example that I love is CD Baby back in the day. You used to be able to sell your CD, physical CDs there, and every fifth CD, they would just keep the money. So the first four CDs, you got the money, and the fifth one, they just kept that and they kept going.
Oh, look, it's first you eat and then we do. It's that pattern.
Yeah.
Right? It's giving and then getting. There you go.
But he took a real, well, it's great because I would still love to do that with my own pricing, but it's hard at the beginning because there's so many variables there. Like, how many CDs are people going to sell? You know, like, or I guess the modern one is streaming, like on Spotify or something. Oh, will I get a million streams? Well, I get a million to one. Like, it's harder to work with that, you know? Mm-hmm. So is it different today? Can you pick up pennies more viably as a self-funded startup, or would you advise against it?
And so by that, you mean charging very little and going for volume of customers?
What I heard when you said, you know, they eat first, is like value-based pricing, like truly on the value you're doing. So once they get the value, if they get value.
Oh, on that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, clearly you have to make it a viable business for yourself. So there's many ways of handling if you wanted to do it that way, there's many ways of handling that. For example, in payments, it's common to have some sort of minimum payment per transaction and then something on top of that. And the something on top of that can scale. But that way, there's this minimum that makes sure that in the simple case, you're still making money. Another one is simply a graduated pricing. You know, when volume is low, you're taking a bigger percentage. And as volume grows, you're taking a smaller percentage, but still more euros in the end of the day in absolute number of euros, but a smaller percentage. So it's sort of like, look, if you're a new, let's say, merchant, and we don't know who you are, you may be paying $10 a month plus 30% of the transaction. But on the other hand, if you're doing millions of dollars a month, and you may still be paying $10 a month and 1% of transactions. And so the payment processor is still making a lot of money, but you know, the person has sort of scaled into it and feels like they're getting a lot of value still. So these are all really common ways of doing that. And that in itself, of course, there's lots of pricing schemes. So that's nothing insightful about that. I think the insight is when you look at all these schemes and ask, geez, which one do I pick? It's hard. That's where having some of these core principles, or here's how we're going to be, either principles because we believe them, or ways that we want to do business, things we think customers will love, or strengths or assets that we have that we need to be leveraging. So we need to, like, always honor that thing because that's part of how we're going to win. That's how you differentiate. That's how you can help cut away the options that are not consistent with that. Because of course, all these pricing things, I mean, you can just look online and see lots of ways to price stuff. So, but it's that, like, but why at the end of the day? Because pricing is just one of many decisions that will need to be consistent with whatever that is. And that way, it's not like, because it's not true that you should make the pricing structure separately from how do we sell to customers, separately from what ways do customers even want to buy, separately from which are the right customers for us to sell to, like which segment of the market. Right? These are not separate questions. And so, you know, just emphasizing that that all has to be cohesive, which again is hard. I'm not saying this is the easy thing to do, but that's why that's the right thing to do. And that helps cut away these many options that are all reasonable.
Yeah. And it takes an independent variable, which is price. You say, okay, this is my pricing, whatever, $49.99, $249. There are many other things that can go wrong. Conversion rates and not being able to find a customer or not. So at least you've removed one independent variable. Just figure out the other ones. Those pricing probably won't be wrong if you're selling to SMBs, probably even prosumers, maybe. Maybe if it's enterprise, you should start at $50,000 or $100,000 a year, depending.
Right. Yeah, I mean, right. That's the thing is, like, when we're talking powers of 10, all of a sudden it becomes real obvious how this works. If you need 300 customers to quit your job, you can probably get them. If you can't get 300 one by one, with the founder of the company being the salesperson willing to spend 45 minutes on the phone with someone to close them, et cetera, and you can't get 300, maybe this company's too hard. Either the product isn't desirable enough, price isn't right, people don't have the pain enough, they don't think they have the pain enough, it's too hard to get their attention, too expensive to get their attention. There's so many different reasons this why it's challenging to make a startup, because so many things have to go right. And it's easy for something to go wrong. So maybe it's just too hard. But if you can scrounge around and do that, then probably you can make it work. And sure, of course, you're going to tweak the pricing and blah, blah, blah. Of course, right? Like, of course, that stuff is not going to be perfect out of the gate. But just power of 10, 300 is doable, whereas 3,000 is not. Like, you're just not going to manually scrounge up 3,000 customers. So if your price is too low, it simply just takes too many customers for that to work out. Now, it's easy to find counterexamples. Oh, yeah, but I have a friend, and they made a product, and they launched on Product Hunt, and then they got 10,000 customers in 2 days. Like, that's great, but that's super, super rare. So yes, of course, but if that one rare magical thing doesn't happen to you, are you saying the startup doesn't work? Because if so, like, I know how this is going to go. So if you would like this to be a little bit higher chance of success, my opinion, you don't want to set yourself. So to me, it's that math. On the other hand, if the price is too high for the customer, obviously it's simply out of their price range, and that's that. So as a power of 10, SMBs can probably pay 2 digits per month, and maybe 3 digits per month if you're delivering more value.
Yeah.
And a consumer might even be scared of paying 1 digit per month. And that's just a power 10, and that's how the math is. Like, you know, like, there's no way around it.
Yeah. Well, I had our first real customer that got us going, Holloman Corporation, I love you, in Texas, and thank you very much, Bryce. He got on the phone, and he was like, our product was $99 a month, and I was like, yeah, I love your product, James, but my only problem is you don't have multi-department. We have lots of departments, and your thing, you don't have multi-department setup, so we can't buy it, you know? And I was like crestfallen, because we were 3 months deep at this stage with a grand total of $100 a month in MRR. And our first co-founder had already quit, because he's like, you guys are losers. This is never going to work. And I said, oh, that's a pity, Bryce. And then out of desperation, I said, well, you could just buy one license for each department. And the phone went silent, you know? And I was like, and he went, yeah, that's a great idea. And I was like, what? And then he said, there's another problem. I said, what? You know, I don't want you to bill me every month. That's it. You know, what, you know? And I was like, well, I could bill you for the year. Oh, you could do that? Yeah. And then he's like, he gave me his card number. And I rang up Rachel. I said, this guy's just given me a card and told me to charge whatever it was, $10,000 to the card. And yeah. I didn't know a credit card could be charged to $10,000 at this stage. I was like, I don't know if it was possible. And Rich said to me, did you charge it? I said, no, let's find out. Bing, and there we are. And that was it. So I love you, Bryce. You got us started.
There you go. Well, it just shows you how differently people think about pricing, and how clearly that was so far below the value that he would pay for, that he was literally just pulling out a card going, well, it's a no-brainer. Even on behalf. So, you know, that's a big signal. Of course, only one data point, so you can't pivot the whole company quite yet. I mean, I'm sure you have now, but I mean, at the time, but it is a great sign. And of course, you always want to leave money on the table. That's good, because that means the customer is feeling like they're getting way more value than the price, which is good. And later on, if you came back to raise prices, they'll be a little more amenable. They might also be more of your advocate. If you said, hey, man, you and I both know, like, you come back to him later, and you probably did. Hey, man, you and I both know, like, you got kind of a deal here, and you deserve it, because you bought on us when no one else would. So you deserve it. Still, it would be really nice if you would give us this case study, blah, 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 so we can turn this around and get some money from other people. And they often will, right? So there's always ways to take that goodwill. When you leave money, I actually hate that phrase of leaving money on the table, because I like to think of it as, you created all this value for the customer. And the question is, how did you split that value with the customer?
Yeah.
Some you leave to them, and some you take in the form. And one form is price. But there can be other forms, like advocacy or signing a case study, doing a joint webinar, and so on. And so when you quote unquote leave money on the table, what you're actually doing is generating a ton of latent value that you could maybe collect later if you want. And if nothing else, you're collecting it automatically in terms of like loyalty and that sort of thing. Like if it comes up for renewal, they're like, hey, why are we getting this tool? What's the likelihood that he's going to go to bat for you? And you're not even in the room. You don't even know this is happening, but it's much more likely. Again, don't know for sure, but much more likely because they feel like they're just getting so much value, which is such a quote unquote no brainer. And you don't even know that. All you know is they renewed. But the fact is, because you left money on the table, you actually created the value. So I think that's the right way to think of that is, oh, I'm creating value in terms of loyalty, advocacy, et cetera. And some of that I can cash in on, like asking for a case study, and some I won't. Some I'll just leave as loyalty, and that's totally fine. So I also don't think it's a math equation that you go write down and solve for X. And, you know, but just broadly speaking, I like to think of it that way. And sure, at scale with thousands of customers, tens of thousands of customers, you might be a lot more rigorous about how you do that. But especially early on, oh man, like this is all valuable. And there's different ways you could ask for that value potentially that is useful to you right then, like getting the next 10 customers. Another thing I like to say is people early on get fixated on those early customers. And to some extent, that's understandable and even good because they are your early customers. You want to keep them and learn from them. So that's good. But you lose sight sometimes of the fact that there's 10 times more customers coming. And there's 10 times more than that coming after that. In other words, 99, maybe even 99.99% of your customers aren't here yet. So what does that mean in terms of your brand? It means you don't have one because almost no one knows it yet. What does it mean in terms of the product? It's like almost irrelevant because almost no one is going to know about the product at this stage and so forth. And so like if you have 10 customers, you could try to nickel and dime them more. Or say, wait a minute, it's not about these 10, it's about the next 100 now. So, but could I ask the 10 to help me in the form of things like case studies, testimonials, et cetera, that would help me with those next 100? That's a good question, because now I'm asking them for help, but I'm not exploiting them for the next 100. And then now I have 100. How am I gonna get the next 1,000? That's usually a different kind of question. I might need different techniques. It might even be different kinds of customers. The product might have to change significantly, maybe pricing, patching, or maybe not. But it might, you know, and again, the question isn't how do I like beat my existing 100 customers to that? It's how can I get those next 1,000 and could they help at all? So with that mentality, which again, I think is based in reality, it's also healthy and constructive. It treats your existing customers well, but still you can look to them for some kinds of support as it were, that doesn't cost them anything that they may be willing to do.
And as a founder choosing a business, like it's so much more satisfying to know you have delivered that value. Like I've been in situations in the past where I charged people a lot of money, they didn't get a lot of value, and that doesn't feel very good. Like yeah. It's fun for the first paycheck, and then you know, not so good. What you want is them getting 10 times more value, because why not? Like you know, if they can't, and oftentimes that can be the case. Your software, like the price is such a it's reflexive. Like what it means to me is nothing to do with what it means to my customer. They could be, right. You know, wind farm in South Africa spending $10 million a day and we're charging them whatever, $1,000 a month. And we're like, their value is way outsized. And it's just nothing. They're in different universes.
Yep.
You pointed on something there, which, you know, about the founder effect, which I think is really powerful when you're getting started. And when my gym buddy Emilio comes to me with his latest idea, I say, have you watched Jason's video yet? And he says, yeah. And then I say, have you emailed 40 people offering to pay for their time, seeing if they would, you know, actually pay you for the product you're pitching me on in the gym at 6 in the morning.
Right.
And no one ever does it. Has anyone ever, I didn't even do it. In fairness, we went a different way. We got prepaid customers. Has anyone ever done that or done it to you? Or have you heard of people doing it? Because it's genius. It's like the next obvious step.
People have definitely done it to me. But often it's because they've read that. And not because I'm the target audience. And so I, in that case, I'm always like, it doesn't matter what I think about your product because I'm not your target audience. My opinion is completely irrelevant. You got to ask the people that are supposed to want this and see what they say. I agree with you that most people won't do that. A lot of people will call customers and just, but not deal with price. But most people won't even do that. They just put their head in the sand and say, I think I just want to do this. And again, of course you can. You're just adding a lot of risk to the business because however you're wrong, you won't know until a lot more time has passed, a lot more money has been spent, all your savings have been depleted, and then you'll just find out. Now, that is a risk, but that's a risk you could mitigate. You've chosen not to. So now when it's 6 months later and you've spent 40K and did all this stuff and people aren't buying it, you don't get to complain because you chose not to find out first whether that would happen. You could have. So I don't know, like, I don't feel too sorry for you because you didn't try. Now, sometimes you make all these calls and learn stuff and then they still don't buy. That's happened to me too. Like, I do this. We still do this at WP Engine, making products. We are a multi-product company. You have to be at scale. That's another kind of mathematical law. So we're constantly trying out new things or big new features, whatever. And sometimes every signal from our conversations with customers is positive. And then when we make it, actually no. And so I've learned a little bit about the questions to ask for that, but I would not say that I've got this problem completely solved. I think it's possible it's just one of those things that happens, but at least you're de-risking. So there have been ideas I have had on my own where I went out to try to sell it with customers and man, could I not do it. So I didn't do those things. See, it works sometimes, you know, and you know, so if you didn't even try, then I don't know. It's like, I don't know what you're just hoping.
Yeah.
And again, there's so many strikes against you for the company working. Why in the world are you accepting strikes or accepting risks that you could have avoided when there's so many that you can't? Like, it doesn't sound right to me. Probably because you don't want to know the answer. Probably because in fact, it's probably not going to work out and you didn't want to know that because you're in love with your idea. And emotionally, that makes a lot of sense. But logically, it's a terrible thing because what it means is you're going to waste your life. You're going to spend 6, 12, 18 months of your life on something that you could have known would never work. And you'll never get that time back. You'll never be that young. You'll never be that smart. You'll never have that much energy again. You could have not wasted it. So don't do that.
Is that just a fear of rejection? Is that it? Simple?
Oh, yeah. Rejection, and also, like, you're in love with your idea and you don't want it to be wrong. Not just because mm-hmm. a person rejected. I guess, I mean, maybe that's the same thing. But I mean, you're just so like, oh my gosh, this would be so cool. And I don't want to find out that it wouldn't be. Let me put it a different way. If you're a founder, you're a weird person already. You have some kind of hubris. Like, who the hell are you? Like, oh, I'm just going to make a thing. And my thing's so much better because I just know what's better than the rest of humanity is ever made in this space. Like, what? And then, by the way, other people are going to agree with me and then pay me for it. And I can build it and I can reach people. Like, who the hell are you? Like, well, how good is this idea really? You know, but you have to have that hubris because otherwise you'd never start anything. So on the one hand, you need that.
Or everyone else would have done it because it's such a great idea.
So you need that optimism. You need that confidence. You need that hubris. No one would ever invent anything. So that's the good news. The bad news obviously is, but like a lot of times you're just wrong about that.
Yeah.
And rather than saying like, that means you're not an inventor, you're not an innovator, you're not an entrepreneur. Rather it's like, oh, that's just not the right idea yet. Like, I'll bet you have lots of ideas for things. This just happens to not be one of the better ones. If you have 10 ideas for businesses over 5 years, I bet some of them are really good. Some are not, right? Yeah. I mean, Edison had to try how many materials before a filament worked? Thousands? I mean, and he's a genius inventor, except he had to try a whole bunch of things, right? Like, that's part of the process, is it not? And it doesn't mean that you're dumb or don't have good ideas or not a good entrepreneur. No, it doesn't mean that at all. It means that you are going to proactively filter your ideas because obviously some are good and some aren't. Duh. And so with that kind of attitude, you realize, oh, I'm not being rejected. I'm just quick filtering some of my ideas, not to prove my best ones are the best, but at least reject the ones that are definitely not the best. That's giving me a better chance, whichever ones survive that, they have a better chance of total survival than it would have been. And I'm not wasting my time. And so when you look at it that way, it's still selfish and hubris and your ideas are awesome. It's just that, of course, 100% aren't. And of course, you need to trim away the ones that are obviously aren't, but obviously is in air quotes because it's only obvious when you talk to customers. It won't be obvious while you sit in your office and think. So that's why you got to go do that. And with that attitude, maybe it's more about the idea rather than yourself that's being rejected. And again, this notion of like, there'll be more ideas, maybe you already have them. It's about finding the best of them by rejecting ones as soon as we can that aren't as good. So we can focus our precious time on the ones that are more likely good. I also have a piece, by the way, on like, well, what should you actually say when you talk to customers? That's hard. What are you interviewing for? How is that directed? How do you learn stuff? How do you do that? So I have a piece on this online. You can search for iterative hypothesis, because that's what I call it. You kind of make a hypothesis and iterate on it, but it's a little more detailed than that, of course. And it's the system that I used to reject an idea before WP Engine, my latest startup. And then also the system I used to validate WP Engine. And then since then at WP Engine, I've continued to use, as I say, for like either major product areas or new products. So I've used this to successfully reject some ideas and accept some ideas. And again, I wouldn't claim 100% success. I would just say this is pretty good. It works pretty well for me. And so especially if you're like, I'm not sure what to ask. Okay, well, start with this. And of course, you'll do whatever you want. You're a founder. You're always going to do whatever you want. No one can tell you what to do. That's, again, part of the two-edged sword of who you are. Fine. But maybe why not start with this? It's maybe in the right direction or 70%, you know, good for you. Why not? So maybe start with that.
Yeah, and there was another article on bit stacking. Was that bit stacking is like a way of evaluating the different ideas? I thought that was really good. People should Google that as well, because you can do this sort of nice, there's different ways of evaluating them on a spreadsheet. Everyone loves doing that. But what you're pointing out is very heartening, is that even so-called god of startups, Jason Cohen, got rejected. So that's normal, expected, right? So.
It's the usual thing. You know, everyone makes mistakes. Everyone gets rejected. Authors of great books got rejected by editors how many times before it was accepted? So therefore, the world at large doesn't always recognize greatness. You know, come on, there's like the stories ad nauseum everywhere about all that stuff. So, that's why I keep in all these, every one of these things, it's always to me about like, would this be easier or would this de-risk? It's never about there's a law you have to do, or this will always be right in all situations. Like this just that doesn't exist. But I do still feel, but as you say, like if they're paying you annually and you have the cash now instead of later, and you can spend that cash now on whatever, product development, sales and marketing, your rent, whatever, that's simply better than getting the money later. So get annual, you should. Is it a law of the universe? No, but like clearly it's better that way than not. So probably all else being equal, you should round off that way or try to do it. So all these things I'm saying are this way. It's just, I think this is a little easier, a little better, a little de-risked. It's always up to you, but like that's what you should be doing, is trying to remove risk or trying to make things easier. Because so many things you can't remove the risk or it won't be easy already. So if you can make it a little better, oh my god, please do that.
The bad news is you need to roll a six. The good news is you can roll as often as you want, right? So you can just keep going and expect, and that's normal. It's normal for your friends to think you're weird for, you know, asking people for money and them saying no. That's normal. That if you're an entrepreneur, if you can't do that, go home. Like that's, I don't know another way to do it. There's some personal risk needs to be there.
Yeah. There's a saying that everything is sales, meaning getting those first few customers is sales, but also getting that first employee to take a risk on you is sales. And if you were to raise money, then that's sales.
Yeah.
And, because on and on with like whatever's going on is like you're trying to convince people of something, which again, honestly, may be irrational.
Yeah.
That first customer, maybe they shouldn't have taken a bet on you. Maybe it's a good chance you're gone in 6 months and they shouldn't have done it. Maybe in some kind of like rational framework, right? Or that first employee, maybe they shouldn't have. Maybe that was irrational. Yeah. So you do kind of need that attitude. And then, of course, people are going to reject you. They may even be right. they may even be correct. You need people that are,
By definition, they are.
Exactly. So, again, that's not bad. That shouldn't stop you. It's just a funny observation of what it's like.
And it's no different, like in product development today, every month we try and every quarter we try and deliver a magical feature to our customers. And we always make the same mistake. have we actually shown this to a customer before we built it? Do we, you know, it's just so, I don't know why it's so hard to do, but to this day, I haven't really learned that lesson. There's one question I want to finish up with, which is a bit of a broader one, but like, has anything really changed? Because what really struck me on this video I was rewatching now today was like, so much of this stuff is still true today. Has anything changed, or has anything changed? You know, would you change your advice today in any way?
Well, I'm sure things have changed. I think some of these fundamental things like full-time attention or annual pay, those are the same, but that's because it's very basic math or human stuff that probably isn't different. I do think the market is different now with regard to things like SaaS products and how people evaluate software. 20 years ago, it was very hard to sell SaaS software. Salesforce was leading the way, but the world had not shifted there. But since that talk, certainly the world has shifted there, and you almost expect everything you ever see to be recurring. Now, whether people like that or not, that's a different question, but it does match expectations. So I think it's way, way easier to have a recurring revenue product now. The support tools, like the other payments and other stuff to support that are there, where it was kind of rough when I started WP Engine and non-existent when I started SmartBear. And again, SmartBear wasn't recurring revenue, so there you go. But I think the tools are there to help, and customers expect it. And I think the sort of science of the metrics around a SaaS company are very well understood now. You know, so that means things like NRR and LTV and CAC and da da da. I don't agree with how everyone thinks about all those things, but at least all these things are really well-worn concepts. There's millions of pieces of content online about it. In other words, there's a lot of things you can use to analyze your business. You'll still have to decide how you want to analyze. But before, like, even those hints at how didn't exist, now there's a lot of that material. That's great because it helps you figure out how to manage your business or analyze your finances. That's good. So I think a lot of the stuff around recurring is easier. One thing right this very second in 2000, and you know, mid 2003 is that the 2023 is that the economy is bad, and that's really hurting a lot of people's ability to charge what they would like to charge or sell at all. So SmartBear started in a recession in 2002, and WP Engine started right after a recession in 2010. So I'm used to building companies when times are tough. And I know that that makes you build a stronger company because you have to, because when times are tough, people won't part with those dollars unless they mean it. So it makes you have to have an even clearer pitch, even better pricing, better, you know, a product that really does deliver value, et cetera, so that people will do it, even though budgets are tight right now. So on the one hand, does that make it harder to start up? Yeah, probably it's higher risk rather than when interest rates are zero, money's going everywhere, people are just spending money and just forgetting they even have it. Yeah, that's an easier time to start a company. On the other hand, when 2023 shows up, those companies go out of business. And we are seeing that. A lot of companies, even that raised a lot of money and have real customers, are going bankrupt, laying off, going because it's not a good business actually that they built. So yes, it's easier to build a business in good times. It's also easier to build something that's not actually a business and then it goes out of business. Is that good or bad? I don't know. I'm just saying that's what it's like. So right now what it's like is it's harder to start because it's harder to get to drag the money out of people. But it also means you're building a real business for sure. If you're a bootstrapper now and you can get to that 10,000, 20,000 in MRR now, oh my, I promise you, you have a great business. How big will it ever be? I don't know about that, but I know you got a real business. And when the times get good, you are so set because you've already, everything in your business is optimized, profitable, you know, well-oriented. And so even when things open up and you start getting competitors that are sloppier, you're still better because you were born when things are hard. You will always be better than them. And your business will be strong for sure because it had to be. Except now it'll be easier to grow and people have more money, maybe raise prices. But like, you know, you start from this fundamentally super strong place because you started when it was hard. So again, which of those is better? I don't know. They're different. But I would say it's a good time to start. Another thing is there's a lot of talent who has extra time, either because they don't have a job or they would like some more money on the side. That's another thing that happens in a recession. And so if it's starting to go, you can probably hire that first employee can probably be really, really good because they're not just sitting at Google making $400K a year doing nothing. those people have been laid off, but they're good. So it can be good for talent or that kind of thing. So there's various things that are nice in the, even though it's hard in a recession, and I've done it myself. And so, yeah, I think it's good. It's not an excuse not to do it.
Well, there's the other thing is your competitors that will never be all stay at home, right? They all think, oh, it's too hard. So there's less people taking a risk. So your competition is down.
That's right. That's right. There's less competition, less market entrance as the academic strategists would call it. That's right. Here's another thing you can do, going back to this notion of you have these core principles that you're going to build around. You could decide, one of my core principles is times are tough and I'm going to be the solution for that. Now that means you have a low price. That's one of the things that means, but wait a minute, low price for whom? So take WP Engine, my current company. We are the largest WordPress platform. So WordPress is a way to build websites. It's the most popular way. 43% of every website on earth is built with WordPress. So very popular. And we have a platform where people build sites and run them on that are WordPress. And we run about 2% of the largest websites on the planet. So pretty good, because the internet's really big. So 2% of infinity is, you know, still a big number. And so we have about 200,000 customers and millions of websites that we run. Okay, so we see a large swath of humanity across the globe and across sizes of sites and companies. So when times are bad, what happens? Well, if I'm a small business, then WP Engine feels expensive, because we do all these things for your site. We make it fast. We make it secure. We have great support. Well, when times are tough and I got no money, maybe instead of paying WP Engine $30 a month for all those services, maybe I can get away with going to a cheap host that doesn't have any of those services, but it's only $3 a month. And, you know, I'd rather have the services, all else being equal, but I ain't got no money, or my business is going out of business. I'm just dying. So on the small end, you might see people who feel like our cheapest plans are still expensive, or just straight up go out of business. So in tough times, the very small businesses are a tough place to be. They ain't got no money or stability. On the other hand, what happens at the large end? For the large end, we might be seen as the cheap option. On the small end, we're the expensive option, but the large end, they're looking at these systems, and I'm sure the caller, your listeners don't know these names, and it's okay, but just suffice to say there's these enterprise website systems, and they cost millions of dollars a year to run. Versus them, we're 10 or 100 times cheaper. Mm-hmm. So for the big guys, our prices seem like a way to save money, whereas for small customers, we are too expensive. Same prices though,
yeah.
Different attitudes, and when times are tough. So although it's tougher for the smaller companies, the bigger companies are like, ooh, we didn't care about you before. We just spent millions of dollars a year and didn't think about it. But now we are thinking about it. Millions of dollars is a lot of money. And so, what are you guys up to again? And so actually business could be booming on one segment of the population because the economy is bad. Yeah. Just as another segment might be bad because the economy is bad.
Yeah.
Now, that's all just us, but the general rule is clear. Different segments of the market respond differently to things like, quote unquote, the economy is bad, interest rates are high, and so on. The different effects. And so going back to these core principles, you may say, hey, so times are tough. I could just go, oh, no, I'll never be able to make this company. Or I could think, well, who's looking for a lower price option when times are tough?
Yeah.
And what would I deliver for them? I don't have to deliver the same as the higher price option because it's lower price. Of course, I'm not going to deliver the same product, but what a great excuse. It costs a lot less. It also does less, but if it does the right fewer things, maybe I can win a lot of that. Maybe. I mean, obviously it's going to be different everywhere in circumstances, but maybe. But in good times, you may never think about that strategy because it would be wrong. That's not how customers are thinking. So if that were right to think that way, you'd say, oh, I got to pick a segment where times are tough and therefore they want to buy a different product rather than they want to not buy. And so that determines my customer segment. It may also mean my prices seem kind of high because relative to the other thing, it's still 10 times cheaper, which yeah. You were probably in that situation with that guy. You were probably way, way too cheap compared, right? And that becomes, again, one of these core things. All right, that's the segment. Here's the pricing. And so now the rest of my decisions have to be consistent around that notion. So what kind of features, blah, blah, blah. Okay. But even with charging, you might say, all right, they're going to have existing contracts that they're waiting out. That might be a barrier to me getting them. So do I need to track? Do I need to ask customers, when does your contract elapse with that other vendor so that you can time your sales to come in and win as that contract, right? Because you want to call them whatever it is, 90 or 180 days before that contract ends, say, look, your contract's coming up. We could save you a whole bunch of money. Maybe you should pilot that right now.
Yeah.
You know, but how does that change what your sales cycle is like and what your pitch is? You know, so again, like it just suggests all these like, wait, if that's true, what are all the other consistent things that we would do and say and position? And on the homepage, we would say, you know, cut your procurement costs by 10x or whatever, or, you know, cut your procurement costs to a tenth. Come see how. Like that's what you put on the homepage if that were the whole message, you know? So again, like this consistency is like trying to identify these magical ways that are how you're going to win. So I know it's a big tangent. Hopefully it's a useful one, but it all came from the question, what's changed? One thing that's changed is the economy sucks right now. And so strategies that might work now could be different. I'm not sure. Some of the tactics are probably still more or less fine, but definitely that's changed. And of course, you know, neither one of us surely want to talk about AI. It's really well-worn and boring. But if you're building a software product now, and you're like, I'm not going to think about AI, but that might be the right decision, by the way, it might be right. A good reason to not do AI is to say AI is changing so rapidly that anything we do is going to be obsolete or different in 6 months anyway. We should just wait, see how it unfolds, and then do something and not get caught up with a whole lot of stuff, which honestly may not deliver that much value anyway to our customers. Screw it. That's a good argument for waiting. The argument for doing it now is, everyone else is doing it. If we don't do it, we're behind. Customers need to at least perceive that we're not behind so they don't leave us for that. They can just be comfortable like, oh, y'all are doing it. Okay, fine. Whatever magic that is, I'll get it by staying. So I'll just stay. And also learning like, yeah, everything's changing. It's going to take years though to get a career going in something as complicated as AI. So you better get started or else you'll just permanently be behind. And so you got to get started now. So that's my argument for starting now. They're both pretty good arguments, to be fair. So again, how do you decide? You go back to those principles. Do my customers actually care? What else am I supposed to? So let's say one of your principles was, we're the innovation leader. Oh, well, then you better freaking do AI or you're not. On the other hand, you might be like reliable and simple and stuff like that. And then maybe AI is not necessary. So of course, I can't make those decisions for you or in the abstract, but that's how I would approach like, geez, both of those sound like pretty smart things to do, and they're and both might be wrong choices too. I mean, it's a risk as always, but like if it's consistent with the rest of my company, I can feel pretty good about that decision.
Yeah, well, I couldn't help but construct an outreach email when you were talking there. Like, hey, Jason, I'm building the first AI toilet seat. Could I pay you for your time to talk to me a little bit about whether or not you go to the toilet every day? Like, it's almost a marketing hook. Like, there's all these AI things. Like it could AI, be, it what? Could be. Like,
I feel like people, AI expands the solution space. It expands what is possible to do. Stuff that you couldn't have done before or way too hard or complicated is now possible. What it doesn't do in my mind is change the problem space. So in other words, your customers, they have things they need to do financially, whether they need to execute it or see reports or track things, whatever they're doing, and your software helps them do it. The fact that AI is here does not change any of that. They still need to do whatever they're doing. What it does change is how you might deliver those things to them. If they want a report, like let's say one of the challenges they have is, hey, we have 200 vendors and I can't remember what they all freaking do. It's possible that AI could help by auto-summarizing them because you have the URL to that vendor because that's just one of the fields you have. So you use AI to like, hit them all because in your company, you have like 10,000 of these URLs across all your customers. So you write code in the back end to hit them all and summarize crap about them. And maybe even you know stuff like how big they are or where they're located or I don't even know what kind of thing it is. You categorize them into buckets. So there's categories and you all that automatically thanks to AI because otherwise it'd be too hard. And then as part of the report they get, their vendor report, they can like expand and get this beautiful wonderful little summary, and they're like, oh, this is great because this helps me understand what's happening here, where we're spending our money. It's categorized, or, you know, whatever it is. So again, if there's a problem they already have that you're solving, or there's a workflow or something that's already there, and AI could somehow make it better, now we're talking.
Yeah.
But AI doesn't change their problem. So like, I would not go to a customer and say like, hey, like, do you want to use AI for things? Like, because no, yeah. Like I have a job to do and you're supposed to be helping me with it. So
yeah.
That's what I mean by AI can expand the possibilities of solutions, possibilities of what features could even be. Yes. Does it change what the customers need? No. So the question to me is like, can we deliver something customers already wanted or would be excited about, let's say, in some way that wasn't possible for before? Oh, if so, like, that sounds super interesting, but not because AI, but because customer and their problems, AI being the how or some kind of conduit that's now here that wasn't before and therefore opened up new possibility. To me, that's the correct way, rather than trying to inject AI into what customers want. I don't think they want it.
Yeah.
If you can build a magic, apparently magical feature for them that they actually want, now we're talking.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's the, you know, sufficiently advanced technology indistinguishable from magic. That's what I love about software. Someone sees it and they go, wow, how does that even work? You know?
Yeah.
And then if you could just know, like the average email from you would be, do you spend X hours doing Y? Would you like to see how AI could do that in 10 minutes? If you know what those X and Y are, that's it. You will always get a meeting.
Yeah, yeah, but replace that same thing with out saying AI, and it's the same message.
Right.
That's my point.
Yes, you're right. Drop the AI.
Right. The point is, I spend too much time on this, and if I could spend less, I'd be happier. The end.
Yeah.
Now, if you're telling me AI is Y, or some algorithm you invented is Y, or the soft, it's just using software where before we didn't use software, and that's why. Great. It's a course that helps me use Excel better, and that's why. Like, these are all solutions. So AI does add to the set of solutions that are possible, which is really cool, really exciting.
Yeah.
And solutions that just simply weren't possible before are now possible. That's super exciting. But the message is just what you said, except the part with AI. Do you spend too much time doing X? Now you can spend less time doing X. Is that interesting or not? You know?
Yeah.
If you were just paying people to do it, and it was that's what it was. Like, look, as long as it costs me this, like, I don't care how you're getting this done, right?
Yeah. I mean, for us, it's kind of turned our junior devs into middleweight devs for free, you know, straight away. And that can happen for lots of things. Like, you know, and definitely our constituency finance teams, they went through this in the 70s. Well, you know, with spreadsheets, the spreadsheets came in and thought all the accountants would be gone. No, there's way more. Thank God for us. There's way more than there ever were before, and they're delivering more value than ever before. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to be respectful of your time, and thank you very much. It's been super cool. I feel like I've been chatting with a friend, and I love all these topics. I'm going to recommend two ways to consume your content. Like, I just want to give the recommendation because you have blog.asmartbear.com. Now, I personally am actually not even really smart enough to read your blog, never mind write it in the first place. So I'm going to pin some of my favorite tweets as well on this. You could do some amazing tweet storms. And I'm not joking. Like, some of your tweets, I still go back to every year. And I say, and each time I read it, I forgot to do that. And even when I went back researching for this podcast, I was like, oh yeah, prepay annual. Yeah, we should work on that 9 years later. So thank you very much for coming on. Is there any other way you'd like people to reach out with you? Where are you on Twitter?
Yeah, it's A Smart Bear, like the animal, on Twitter. And the website's the same, asmartbear.com.
Awesome. Jason, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So that wraps it up for another episode of the Gross Profit Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing and leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever it is you get your podcasts.